funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to make sense of your senses? Those of us with typical function rarely think about the ways that taste, touch, sight, smell, and hearing help us understand and navigate the world. We learn from infancy to read our senses and rarely feel confused about the cues they offer about our surroundings. But for children with sensory processing disorders, certain day-to-day experiences can be overwhelming or understimulating, making the effort to interpret sensory cues exceptionally stressful or even frightening. So what puts certain kids at risk for sensory problems? How do those problems manifest themselves in behavior? And what can be done to help kids overcome the confusing messages they might be receiving from their own bodies and brains? Lindsay Beal is a pediatric occupational therapist in private practice. Her new book, written with Nancy Pesky, is called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. Lindsay, welcome to Think.
Hello.
Can you start by talking about what a sensory processing disorder is and what it can feel like to somebody who suffers from it?
Well, let's start by looking at what is this process all about. All of us learn about the world and through about ourselves through our senses. Sensory processing is how we take the information from within our own bodies and from the outside environment and transform that into messages that we can act upon. So it's tempting to think of the senses as separate channels of information, but really they work all together to give us a reliable picture of the world. There are five senses that we all know about, touch, taste, sound, smell, vision, and there are two additional senses that are a little bit less familiar for people, and the first one of those is called proprioception, and that's an internal body awareness. That's how you know if you put your hand behind your head, that's how you know where your hand is without looking at it. Then there's one other sense that's not very well known, and that's the vestibular sense. And that's how our bodies receive information and interpret that information when it comes to movement or changes in relationship to gravity. That's how you know that you're moving when you're in an elevator. You can feel that within your own body. So we use all of this information pretty automatically to function in our daily lives. For people who have troubles with the sensory processing, the information is not coming in so reliably, and it can be a difficulty pulling the information in or linking it up all together inside the body. So what does it feel like for that person? Let's look at what it looks like from the outside. The most obvious thing to look for is out-of-proportion reactions to sensory experiences that most of us just think are pretty normal and we kind of take for granted. Things like a child may be extremely sensitive to sounds. A child may have a meltdown every time you go turn on a hairdryer or the vacuum cleaner. They may not be able to tolerate that high-frequency sound. A child may be bothered by clothing fabrics, labels and tags in their clothing, itchy little threads. Now, all of us are annoyed by these itchy threads that are in clothing these days. I cut out all the clothing tags because I find them quite annoying. But these are kids who are really, really sensitive to this kind of thing. Kids may fuss or refuse to touch certain substances like glue or finger paint or be very uncomfortable when it's time to put on some suntan lotion. A child may squint or blink even though the vision is just fine. They may be bothered by lights or patterns. Often kids will be very picky eaters, and this is well beyond the typical toddler picky eating. This is a strong reaction to feeling different textures or temperatures inside the mouth, and these problems may persist well beyond the toddler years into teen years and even adulthood. Kids will often have poor motor skills, have difficulty using scissors, learning to button a shirt, learning to do shoelaces, difficulty with gross motor skills like running and jumping. a child may get overstimulated very easily. You can imagine if a child is so sensitive to all of the lights and the sounds and the smells, walking into the grocery store would be really, really uncomfortable. So the child may actually be in pain going into certain sensory environments that we might find annoying, like a crowded shopping mall, but a child may actually find that painful.
And the other side of the same coin, while some children may be hypersensitive to these stimuli, others may be hyposensitive, not as sensitive as everybody else.
Absolutely. You know, the easiest form of this to recognize is the hypersensitivity, the child for whom everything seems too loud and too much. On the other side of that coin is the hypo or underreactive child who needs a lot of input for it to really register. This is the child who's kind of slumped over the couch like a wet noodle watching TV, and it takes an awful lot to get him or her motivated and moving. This child may need a lot of strong input, bright lights, activating music, maybe some chewing gum or spicy foods. And what kids will often do, especially at school, is if they're this kind of hypo-responsive kid, they know they're on a nervous system level they need to rev up their own bodies. So they'll do that because they know they need to pay attention. And because their nervous system is working so poorly, sometimes kids over-rev up their engine so that their internal nervous system starts working too quickly, and they end up looking hyperactive when, in fact, it's an underactive nervous system.
Well, Lindsay, what's got to be so vexing about this for parents who have a child who may have these problems or for teachers is that at the 50-yard view, this just looks often like poor behavior, like a kid who's just not in control of his or her behavior. What clues can parents use to think, no, this is more than just that?
Well, you know, it's really a matter of degree. I think of all the sensory stuff as spectrum. You know, on one end of the spectrum is the child who's, you know, a little annoyed by that and is kind of a picky eater and is using, let's use the picky eating. You know, oh, no, I don't want to eat that kind of macaroni and cheese. I don't like it. And, you know, it becomes sort of a behavioral thing, a control issue with the parent, or just part of being a toddler and asserting your independence. And then the kids who really have strong sensory issues, it's so way out of proportion that it kind of can't be mistaken if you really stop and think about it and look at, is this a behavior the child is able to control? When it's a strong sensory issue, that becomes fairly evident as well. It's the thing somewhere in the middle that can be very vexing for parents. Like, is it sensory? Is it behavioral? I say it's never one thing or another. The sensory contributes to the behavioral. Once the behavior is in place and set, it contributes to the sensory. And that's why it's really important to get someone in who's very much aware of sensory integration issues, who can help the parent to assess exactly what's going on and start to suss out, okay, what can be helped, what can be improved, what is purely behavior, what kind of behavioral techniques are we going to use to deal with the behavioral aspects.
We're talking about sensory processing disorders with pediatric occupational therapist Lindsay Beal. Her new book is called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. Let's talk for a minute about some of the things that might predispose a child to this. No one's exactly sure why some kids have it and some don't, but things like birth trauma and even adoption and prematurity can be factors in this.
Absolutely. It all boils down to a person being wired differently. There have been a lot of scientific studies done on sensory processing issues, and at its core is a system that's wired differently so that some of the arousal centers of the brain are functioning in a way that's not typical, so that an innocuous touch on the arm is being experienced by the nervous system as a true assault and triggering flight or fright kinds of responses. So it's a wiring difference. So now the question is, what causes the wiring difference? How did this child end up being like that? There's a lot of different reasons. We're seeing a lot of sensory processing issues in children who are adopted from overseas. These are children who may have been born to a parent that did not get proper prenatal care, and then they may have experienced a birth trauma and then been put in an institutional environment with very poor experiences in that environment. Not a whole lot of stimulation, not a lot of movement, a lot of gentle touches. Adoption issues. Prematurity is very, very common in children who are born prematurely, especially the youngest and the smallest. When a child is born prematurely, his or her nervous system has not yet been fully wired and coated with all those protective factors neurologically that enable an infant to handle the barrage of sensory input. So we know that young infants are very sensitive to begin with, and then you can imagine when they're not quite cooked yet, they're really not ready for the barrage. And usually those children do, with good input, get over their issues by about age two.
And does this typically manifest itself first in infancy, or can this come on and be apparent only much later?
Well, you know, a parent may have, especially for the child who is hyper-reactive to input, a parent may notice that the child doesn't like to be cuddled quite as much as other children, or the child just insists on being swaddled all the time, or a baby may not sleep unless she is rocked back and forth in the arms or in a stroller. Child may require a lot of bouncing, a lot of different kinds of input. So sometimes it manifests in infants. In other instances, it may not be noticed until the child starts school. So the child is at home and everything becomes pretty predictable at home, and mom learns how to handle her baby in a way that the baby's happy.
Perhaps without even realizing it, excuse me.
Well, exactly. Mm-hmm. Our babies teach us an awful lot about how they like to be touched. Mm-hmm. I'm always very sad when I go in and I work with a new parent who says to me, "I don't think my baby likes me." Mm. And in those cases, you know, we do a lot of work together and try to figure out what's going on there, because of course her baby loves her. But sometimes a parent needs to learn how to hold her child a little bit differently. Maybe a parent overstimulates the baby, singing and rocking and having bright lights might be too much for the baby. So we'll work on getting a nice match between mom and the baby. But more often than not, parents are really good at just reading those cues and altering their parenting style.
Let me stop you here, because we'll take a quick break. Lindsay Beal is my guest. She's a pediatric occupational therapist who's written a new book called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. You can join us by getting on the line now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is pediatric occupational therapist Lindsay Beal. Her new book is called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. So, Lindsay, let's talk about the moment at which a family presents to you looking for some help in dealing with this. What sorts of forms would that therapy take?
Okay. Well, one thing, and it does my answer will dovetail with what you were asking before, is does it sometimes crop up later on in life? Sometimes a child will do really well at home, and then suddenly at school, the child begins to have troubles because there's just so much going on in the classroom. So I will typically get... parents will get in touch with me at two different points. First, through when they're very young. A child is very young. If a child is under age 3, that would be through early intervention. And then a child age 3 or older would be through the local school system. And what therapy looks like is, well, there's a couple of different things. Therapy to work with children who are having sensory issues needs to be multi-pronged. Number one, immediately, I need to take a look at the environment. And what is it that's setting this child off? And we need to change that in the environment right away. Because the child needs to function in his or her daily life. So if a child is extremely sensitive to fluorescent lighting, for example, and is having meltdowns because she can see and hear the fluorescent lights in a classroom, I need to deal with that first thing. Meanwhile, I'm going to work on bolstering his or her underlying ability to tolerate all different kinds of sensory input. So I will do an environmental analysis, and then also quite important to understand how this child works. I do a thorough assessment of the child's various sensory systems and developmental skills, and then we start to look at where things are breaking down, and that's how we set goals. I work with a parent always to set mutually set upon goals, because it's very, very important that parents get on board here. Now, I may work with a child in the classroom, if a child's struggling at school. I may work with a child in their home, or I may refer out to what's known as a sensory gym. A sensory gym is a wonderful environment with a lot of suspended equipment, like swings and slides and ladders that are hanging from the ceilings, and all kinds of wonderful safe ways where kids can start to explore sensory input that they would typically find intolerable. In a sensory gym, a child works one-on-one with an OT. It's not like a regular, gym time, toddler time kind of class. And I keep mentioning toddlers and young children I work with, and OTs like me work with older children as well as young adults and adults. And in a setting like a sensory gym, a child will slowly build his or her tolerance of intolerable sensory input, or if the difficulty is under sensitivity, to slowly sensitize that child to what he or she really needs to get more of. One of the ways that I figure out what it is that the child needs is I look at the behavior. And oftentimes, the behavior will give me the clues that inform my interventions. For example, if you have a child who is engaging in a self-stimulatory behavior, spinning in circles, flapping his or her hand in front of his face, jumping up and down, swatting himself on the ears, this gives me important clues. And I start to analyze what it is that this child's nervous system needs to calm him or herself down. So it's a slow building on where the child is at, slowly increasing the amount of sensory input that he or she can handle.
I know that there are some anxiety issues and some confidence issues that can come along with sensory processing disorders. How do you explain what this is to the child himself or herself who is your patient?
Well, it depends on how verbal the child is, clearly. But I start to give words to some of the experiences that no one may have ever given a word to. I notice by about age 2, age 3, depending on the child, they start to notice that other kids are not experiencing things the same way. All the other kids seem to be comfortable touching glue or playing in the sandbox. And that's hard for a child to begin to recognize that he or she is different. So I simply will tell children, really children of any age, that your body is different. Your body is experiencing that sound a different way. That sounds very loud for your ears. It's loud for my ears, too. Here's what we can do about it. If a child is really disgusted by getting glue on his or her hand, we'll explore it together. You know, if you take a child out of the situation where there are 20 screaming children and you work with them one-on-one, they're much more willing to explore intolerable sensations. Like, let's take the glue example. I'll put some glue on my hands, and I'll give them the words for what I think they're experiencing. Like, oh, that glue feels disgusting. Ew, gross. But wait a minute. It's kind of cool at the same time. It's sticky and yucky, and if I rub my hands, it dries up and it goes away. That's so cool. You know, this kind of thing, so that I teach them the self-talk to help them deal with some of the emotions that they're feeling instead of just panic.
Lindsay Beal is my guest. She's a pediatric occupational therapist whose new book is called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Lolly in Tyler. Hey, Lolly.
Hi.
Hi.
I kind of want to tell you about my situation. I guess maybe I was born over 50 years ago, but my mother always told me, and I was the fourth child. I wasn't like her first, that she didn't know what to do with. But the whole first year of my life, she said, I cried all the time. If I wasn't eating or sleeping, I was crying. Mm. And she would take me to the doctor, and they couldn't find anything wrong with me. But she said it went on a whole year.
Oh.
And have you ever heard of that?
I have. I have heard of that. And, oh, how hard it must have been for you and for your mom and everyone else. I don't know what was going on with you, but you were clearly very, very unhappy. And for some babies, it can be stomach problems or an earache or just being really, really uncomfortable inside your body. Did your mom tell you how she used to try to soothe you and what worked and what finally helped her to stop you from crying?
They settled on giving me soybean milk, but she said that still wasn't, you know, a total cure.
They thought it was a food allergy.
Because even later on, she would say I would be standing in front of the full-length mirror watching myself cry. So it happened till, you know, a whole year I was able to stand up, you know. She said it went on for a year. And later in life, I was fine during school. I never had any other kind of problems. But just wondered what you might know. And then I also kind of wanted to ask you another thing. Y'all haven't mentioned autism yet. Would this be related to autism?
You know, when you're on a radio show, there's just so much to talk about. Sensory issues are experienced by all kinds of people, just regular kids. There's one in every regular ed classroom of kids that have some fairly significant sensory issues. In a classroom of people with autism, that's probably about 80% of the children in that classroom. The vast majority of people with autism do have some kind of severe sensory issue. It's one of the hallmarks of autism, and in people with autism, it tends to be the most significant of all. I mean, we're talking about sounds can get so loud that the person, their brain will just shut off all hearing, and they'll have to tune out the whole world altogether because the sensory input is so painful. So, yes, it's huge in autism. It's also very common in attention deficit disorders, also common in fetal alcohol syndrome and Down syndrome and physical disabilities. So it's quite common in many of these scary diagnoses. And I do want to point out, though, that just because a person has some very significant sensory issues doesn't mean that they have any other kind of diagnosis. Sometimes it's just the sensory stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Plano, and we'll speak with Priscilla. Hi, Priscilla.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank
Hi.
You.
I'm so enjoying this conversation. I have a 19-year-old daughter, and when she was four, she started cutting with the little nub-nose scissors the seams out of her socks.
Wow.
And it was considered just, you know, a terrible behavior. And over time, what I realized was the seam in her sock just drove her crazy. And eventually we went to no socks at all. Also with her underwear, she started early on, underwear was such an issue, and she finally resolved it by wearing them inside out so that the seam wasn't hitting her. And, of course, my mother and there were others who just thought this was all acting out and everything else, but I could see the pain and the discomfort. And there were other issues involved. Eventually, she was diagnosed with ADHD, but one of the problems I had was they were treating the ADHD. There were medications and lots of therapies and everything. But as far as the sensory integration issues, I really had trouble finding somebody who could work with her on those. And to this day, at 19, she can't wear any shorts or pants with pockets because if they hit the inside of her elbows, it just makes her crazy.
You know, the clothing issues are so, so common, and I'm always fascinated when I hear about a child who figures it out for herself and starts to fix things by herself. Fortunately, a lot of clothing manufacturers are getting wise to this, and there are so many seamless sock companies out there now. A great one is called Smart Knit Kids. There's just loads of them. And one of the things that I tell parents to do is just turn the socks inside out and, you know, remove those clothing tags and launder the clothing really, really well. One of the things that I'm proudest of in my book is that I've written a huge, like one-third of the book is about practical solutions. Mm-hmm. If your child is having trouble with boots, tolerating the feeling of boots, here's 10 tips to try. If your child struggles with toothbrushing, here's 10 tips to try. So it's all about finding practical solutions for some of these daily life issues. And I hope that your daughter has finally found someone who can help her figure out more of these everyday solutions and decrease some of her sensitivity.
If this goes untreated, is it going to be an issue for life?
Well, you know, sometimes children with very mild issues do grow out of it, but what I find is that some of the sensitivities last. As adults, we can regulate ourselves to a great extent. If I need help concentrating, I pick up a stick of gum and I chew on that, and that helps me to focus. Or if I'm kind of wound up, I'll take a hot shower at the end of the day, and that kind of helps me to soothe myself. Kids don't really have access. A child in the classroom can't raise their hand and say, you know what, teacher, I'm a little bit, you know, I'm a little edgy right now. I really need to go for a quick run. I'll be back in 10. You know, it doesn't work that way for kids. As adults, we learn ways to help our bodies feel better. I think that what happens for sensory issues that stay around for a lifetime, We become better at self-advocating and figuring out the solutions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Lisa in Plano. Hey, Lisa.
Hi. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and when she was four, she was diagnosed with sensory integration, and she had the spatial and vestibular issues. Mm-hmm. And she did occupational therapy in a sensory gym like you were talking about, and that got her to a point where she was able to function at her age level, you know, at four.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's 10, and she's starting to participate in organized sports, and we can really see a difference in her abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I know she's never going to be a natural athlete, but she really wants to do these things, and I've been wondering what I can do with her to help her develop, you know, kind of continue on with some of the improvements that she got when she was younger, and whether going back to that kind of sensory gym is appropriate at that age, at this age.
Right. Sensory gyms can be really great with kids at any age. Of course, you want to go to one that doesn't, you know, when your child would walk in, would not have a bunch of, you know, six-year-olds running around. Would have to be an age-appropriate group of kids there at that time. I'm most interested in having her participate with her peers, because at this age, that's what's most important. So I would love to see her get involved as much as possible with non-competitive sports. I don't know what kind of sport she's going after, but if she can compete with herself, that's the best person, so that there's less pressure to perform. I would say practice with her outside of the group situation, so you can help her build her skills. And also, you may be able to find kind of a personal coach who's good at building the skills.
Lindsay Beal is with us. She's a pediatric occupational therapist who's written a new book called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment and do have one line open at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is pediatric occupational therapist Lindsay Beal. Her new book is called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. We will go on the phones now to Red in Oak Cliff. Hello, Red.
Hi. I just visited my five-year-old cousin over the weekend and watched as he was in the room as Mom started frying bacon for breakfast one morning, and he had to go down into the basement because it was so painful to him. Before it was all over, he actually was throwing up twice.
Hmm.
It's otherwise a bright, you know, important 5-year-old boy. And
Red, I'm so sorry. We're having serious phone line issues and weren't able to hear you, but I think maybe you can talk for a minute, and we still seem to be having phone line issues.
Sure.
Lindsay, about that intense reaction to scent.
That's very intense, and I actually, you know, it's fascinating, that kind of very, very intense reaction to smell, and I think it should be checked out with a doctor. Sometimes that can be due to a nutritional imbalance, but it sounds like ruling that out, it sounds like a really, really strong sensory issue. And in a case like that, what you want to do is, that's one of the cases where you have to take a look at the environment and re-engineer the environment to suit that child, and that's so intolerable for this child. maybe the bacon shouldn't be fried in that child's home. Maybe the child just can't tolerate it. You know, I would think of that like an allergy. If a child were allergic to a certain food, we wouldn't give him that food. So they may want to rethink cooking that kind of thing in the home, and they can start to look at ventilation and that sort of thing. In terms of sensitivities like that, what do you do? You can't just eliminate all of these different sensory experiences from a child's life. I mean, smells and tastes are a fact of life. Temple Grandin, who wrote the foreword for my book, Raising a Sensory Smart Child, is probably the most famous person in the world who has autism. And she tells the story of her mother saying, Temple, there you can pick three foods that you absolutely will never, ever have to eat, and the rest you'll just have to learn to tolerate. So in a situation like this young child who's so terribly uncomfortable with the smell of, I think it was bacon, maybe they need to pick three smells that this child will never, ever have to smell, at least in his or her own home.
Now, continue.
One of what I would suggest to parents also to do is take a look at the sensory checklist that I have. I have it in my book, and I also have it online on my website, which is Sensory Smarts, SensorySmarts, SensorySmarts.com. And there's a checklist that you can print right off my website and fill out and start to look. And, you know, if there are a couple of things that seem unusual in the child, you know, it's no big deal, nothing to worry about. But if you start to see that there's a real pattern going on and that there are some significant sensitivities, either oversensitivity or undersensitivity, then it's time to look into getting some help.
Is there any relationship between sensory processing disorders and things like synesthesia, where the brain sort of confuses the information it's getting or makes a connection that nobody else understands?
Synesthesia is such a fascinating condition. It's really quite rare, and it's blending or crossing over the senses so that someone will smell something that makes them see something pointy, for example. It's a fascinating thing worth reading about. You know, synesthesia, it's so rare, but it does speak to that different kind of wiring, which is what we're talking about. The brain, during development, so many billions of neural connections are made in the brain, and sometimes they get connected in a way that's kind of unusual. I think the brain of the synesthete is overly connected. There are just so many connections between the different sensory cortices in the brain. Sensory processing, just so much of it seems to be wired into the arousal centers of the brain.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Jenna in Dallas. Hello, Jenna.
Hello.
Hi,
Jenna.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. I'm calling about sound sensitivities. In specific, like a movie theater, just completely overwhelming for a child.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could speak to that, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely. The sound in, how old is your child?
Let me get her back.
Oh, okay.
Jenna, I'm sorry, how old is your child?
She's five.
Five.
Okay. All right. That's about the age where she should be able to go to a movie comfortably. For some children, it's just too loud in there. So the Autism Society of America has actually teamed up to do what's called Sensory Friendly Movie Night. And just go into a web browser and look up sensory friendly movies, and you'll get right to the website and find out if there's one in your area. So that's a great thing, where the movie theater actually turns down the volume and turns out the lights a little bit. And a lot of kids who have autism or not have autism, just find that they're much more comfortable on those sensory-friendly nights. There's no reason why your child can't wear sound-reducing earplugs for during the movie. You go right to the drugstore and find a pediatric fit and put those in your daughter's ears, and that's just going to muffle, reduce the decibel level enough on the movie so that the sound won't bother her quite as much. You can also get earmuffs that go over the ears right at your Home Depot. They're, I guess construction workers have them. You can go to the earplugstore.com, and they sell children's earmuffs that reduce sound. If your child is frightened by specific sounds, so instead of just talking about general noise level, specific sounds, let's say children are very frequently frightened by the sound of thunder or dogs barking, that you can go ahead and record the sound that your child is afraid of, and then sit down together, you know, cozy time with your child, let's listen to those doggies barking on the radio, you know, and put it in your CD player, and let your child control the volume, like, let's make the doggies bark really loud. You know, you turn the sound way up, and if your child gets frightened, you say, oh, that's too loud, let's turn it down a little bit, and it just lets the child explore those sounds in a way that's safe, so that when it desensitizes her, so that when she goes out on the street and sees a barking dog or hears the thunder, it's not quite as terrifying. There are also two CDs that are out that I know of. One is called Sound Ease, and the other is called School Ease. And these are CDs that take a sound like, let's say, thunder, and they pair it with very soothing, calming music so that the child gets lulled into calm by the music, and then slowly the sound of the thunder behind it comes up a little bit louder and louder, and the child learns how to predict that sound and learns that, you know, it's not so terrible. You can find those CDs on my website, SensorySmarts, with an S at the end, .com.
Yeah, I was really surprised to read that sometimes even a sensation that really bothers a child, suddenly they become sort of fascinated by it when they can reproduce it themselves and they're in control of how loud or how soft a sound is, for example.
Yes. A lot of it is about unpredictability, so that you may have a child who, you know, doesn't like to be touched lightly, but if they initiate light, tickly touches, they love it. It's about predictability and control for a lot of kids.
Let's go next on the phones to Lisa in Dallas. Hello, Lisa.
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi. I have boy-girl twins. They are four. And from birth to 6 months old, my son was just a little stoic, often an expression. He cried a lot. I think after his digestive system developed some, he became a little bit better. And he's bright and wonderful, but we've had put him in occupational therapy for about 10 months when he was 3 years old because he had a lot of issues of holding things, attention issues. He could do the task, but if he got distracted, he wouldn't listen. And he also has a sensitivity to sound. He'll hold his ears. We had him tested, and they ruled out autism. They ruled out Asperger's, and we did a blood test, ruled out any kind of genetic issues. And my question was, one, Children's Hospital in Dallas said it's not uncommon to have boy-girl twins, and the boy come more often than the girls for fine motor skills. Do you see that being true? Or
I actually do see that being quite true. You know, it's a generalization, but typically speaking, girls develop a little bit more quickly than boys, especially with the fine motor stuff. So I don't have the norms at the top of my head, but I do frequently see that in children. A little boy holding things in his hand and getting having some trouble with his attention, these are things that you can work with, okay? Let's first talk about the holding things. I don't know if listeners know what that looks like. I work with a lot of kids. You go to their house, you want to play with them, but they have one little tiny toy in each hand, and they're holding on to those little tiny toys, and you can't get them to do anything because they've got those little tiny toys. Mm. And I often see that as I'm going to hold on to my little safe things because I don't know what you're going to make me do. And it's the same kind of behavior that I see with a child who just sits with a little toy truck and rolls it back and forth repetitively. And it's like, I'm really good at rolling my little truck, and I'm going to stick to doing that because I don't know if I can do what you want me to do. So that's the first thing you got to deal with is getting some measure of success, getting that toy out of his hand and engaged in something that is guaranteed to be successful for him. When a child has so many different attention issues, again, you need to first start by re-engineering the environment. When I go into people's homes, I will frequently see just an explosion of toys. It looks so exciting. There's, 50 different cars and puzzles and games and the video's on and the music's on, and it's very overstimulating for a lot of children and absolutely for a child with attention issues. I counsel parents, pick out about 10 toys, put the rest away. Put them in opaque bins, out of sight, out of mind. And that's not because I'm a meanie, but because I want the child to really explore those 10 toys and really learn how to expand upon their play with that. So you're going to reduce the visual stimulation. Put up curtains if you already have stuff up in bookcases, but the child can still see them. Put some curtains, get a little tension rod, and stick some curtains up over those bookcases. Reduce some of the auditory distractions. Set up one area in the house, maybe the child's special play area, that's really pretty distraction-free because you really want the child to be able to not be at the mercy of his senses. You really want the child to be able to focus in on what he's doing and develop those very, very essential fine motor and gross motor skills.
In the last 30 seconds or so that we have left, I would imagine that you think it's very important, if a family is coping with this, to communicate whatever the issues are, even if they're being dealt with outside, to teachers and other caregivers.
Teachers are so important. Often parents will say, I don't want them to think badly of my child, that my child is a problem child. And, if the child is having trouble at school, the teacher's going to know it. The first thing. It's very, really important to partner up with the teacher and say, look, here are the things that we know work really well at home. And, if you're having this problem in school, you might want to try this, this, and this. There are lots of tips for advocating for your child at school in our book, Raising a Sensory Smart Child, and a lot of different ways to
We are just about out of time, Lindsay.
Time. Okay.
I'm so sorry. Lindsay Beal is a pediatric occupational therapist. Her new book is called Raising a Sensory Smart Child. It's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.